Welcome, Frank.
Well, thanks, Dee, and I'm glad to be here, and happy birthday to your mother.
I appreciate that. One of the things that we talked about that we'd like to discuss tonight was what we refer to as blofos.
Mm-hmm.
The typical, I took the picture and didn't notice this object until I downloaded it to my computer.
Right. Yeah, the term invented by James Neff, webmaster for the rent site, which very adequately describes another phenomenon, a sub-phenomenon of the UFO phenomenon, to be exact.
Are you like me in noticing that it's a lot of bugs and birds?
Yes. I mean, the short answer to that is yes. This particular sub-phenomenon or the attention given to things that are captured by now the latest technology, digital cameras and video, etc., that's always been with ufology. There have always been photographs, anomalous photographs that have been caught that, in fact, it goes up and down with the waves of ufology. When there are more sightings, there will be more anomalous photographs that will eventually be, with research, will be conventional objects. And very oftentimes are bugs and birds, etc., or perhaps a conventional craft that's bird. But people, and in fact, you just said it, you described it well, that people don't actually see these things when they're taking photographs. They come back, they upload the images to their computer, and voila, there's a UFO. Part of our job is to separate the wheat from the chaff, and unfortunately, given the fact that everybody walks around with a camera phone on their hip, there's more chaff these days.
Unfortunately, that's true. You see on filers' files all these blurry photographs going, okay, so what's the big deal on this one? Or on a lot of internet sites, you see these blurry images.
Admittedly, I'm guilty of the same thing at the UFO Chronicles. I try not to, we are a one-stop shop for UFO reports, so oftentimes, we will host something that I can look and say, well, that's a bug. So I'm guilty of the same thing. If we sit down and analyze something, or if somebody asks my opinion on something, that's a different story. And I guess in my own defense, if something appears on the UFO Chronicles, that doesn't necessarily mean that we endorse it as the publisher or the editor. But it does, we have to separate the wheat from the chaff.
But at least on your website, you do say, okay, if anybody knows what this is, let us know.
Well, certainly.
And you post it. You just don't post it out there and say, okay, this is it. This is a UFO.
Well, somebody the other day, there was a little bit of criticism that had come in, I think either in one of the articles in the comments section, or perhaps it was just a private email to me. I don't recall. I literally get hundreds of emails daily. But I responded and I said, listen, we try to be fair with everybody. I'm not biased to what comes in. And quite frankly, a good portion of the site is set up by script. And we do this so we don't miss anything, that comes in on the internet as a whole. So literally things appear on our site in real time. And I don't have a lot of control over that after the script is written. And these things pop up. I said, if you have criticism directed towards me personally, then by all means, look at some of the articles that I've written and critique those, because I stand behind those and those are my opinions. If it's something that just appears on there in that sense, of course you can add a comment, but it doesn't necessarily mean that I endorse it. And like James alerted us to in his article a couple of years ago, this what he calls blurfos, this goes on. People take pictures of bugs, and I think in your email to me, you cited that one article that I wrote, and I entitled it, "It's a Bird, Damn It."
Yes.
these were shots taken by somebody at the beach, which, you know, there's some seagulls there, and they were just taking scenery shots, and they went home and they uploaded their images to their computer, and again, voila, you know, there's a UFO. In this particular instance, it was very easy to deduce that it was a bird, with a little bit of photographic analysis, as well as common sense in regards to where the individual took the picture, the fact that there are gulls there. And we were actually able to narrow that down to the specific seagull that's prevalent in that area. And yet, given that evidence, the photographer still argued the point. You know, I mean, he was certain that it was an alien craft of some sort.
That happens quite often.
Well, certainly it does.
And then also sometimes people will see a satellite going through the sky.
Mm-hmm.
One place that people can go to check on times and locations of different satellites, there's a website called JTRAT3D
mm-hmm.
that people can go to. Do you find that you get a lot of people reporting satellites as UFOs?
Because
they do move so quickly.
Yes, we get reports of all sorts. You know, as, I mean, we ask for reports. It's at the top of the site. Please report your UFO experience. And yeah, you get and you know, some people who are ignorant to the subject, if they see something that does not fit into their mindset, if it seems out of the ordinary to them, and of course initially, and I use the term UFO in the verbatim. It's an unidentified flying object. So I accept that report or anecdote as just that. It's an unidentified flying object. Let's look into it. Or oftentimes somebody will send me photographs and they'll, you know, what do you think this is? And because I've looked at so many IFOs, identified flying objects, oftentimes I'm very, it's easy for me to decipher just what the object is, particularly with either bird or bug shots at right angles, because there's a pattern in the image of the wing. And I've been able to analyze this just basically by experience, because I've seen so many of these shots. There was a researcher a while back, a few years ago, that had created a database of IFOs, of various bugs, birds, etc. Her name escapes me at the time, and I haven't heard from her lately. She's kind of gone off the radar, pun intended. But she had a couple of databases set up that were very, I thought, very important to ufology, because people could cross-reference known objects when a photograph of an alleged UFO came into being. So it was great to contrast her work with what people, witnesses, may have thought was an anomalous object.
Well, and then a lot of times, you know, in the instance of people taking a photograph of something and then say, oh, later on I found it when I downloaded it, a lot of times, you know, they get excited, oh, I got to report this. I'm not trying to say don't report it, you know, let people look at it and identify what's in it if possible and go from there.
Well, and I think it was you in an email that suggested that perhaps an organization like MUFON should propose some sort of educational methodology for the layperson, that they could do a little analysis on themselves before they do, in fact, pass it on to an organization like MUFON, or before passing it on to the UFO Chronicles. I'm with you. I mean, if you think you have something anomalous, if you don't think it's a conventional object, by all means, send it on. I mean, to me, it's the cost of doing business. We have to sort out the chaff to get to the wheat. So that's a given. On the other hand, you know, you'd want the observer to use common sense. And there again, remember, history has taught us that the bulk of UFO sightings or UFO reports at the end of the day after investigation are, in fact, identifiable objects. either a natural phenomena or a conventional object. That ratio has always been that way. Of course, you and I are interested in the things that aren't a conventional nature or natural phenomena. But the higher percentage, of course, generally can be explained overall, and that's been the rule of thumb since the onset of what we would call modern day ufology.
This is true. One of the biggest things you hear from people is about videos and stills is blurry objects or shaky film.
Mm-hmm.
What a lot of people don't realize is a lot of the shakiness in videotapes, for example, is because people try to zoom in on the object and they're doing this handheld.
Mm-hmm.
And the more you zoom in, the more your natural handshake, I guess you could say.
Creates an effect unto itself. You can take a static light in the sky. Well, you could take Venus, you know, for that matter, and film it, and it can appear, depending on the type of camera you're using and the settings, it can appear to be what we call the sky snake. We've comically nicknamed the sky snake. In fact, that happened. I forget the gentleman's name that took the photograph that was associated with the Stephenville incident. That made headline news for a while, and it was a very interesting picture. Again, based on my own experience, I wasn't too excited about it, and it didn't prove to be too much at the end of the day after investigation. But these things do happen. I think it's important to point out a picture by itself at the end of the day is just that. Without any corresponding evidence, it could be a very exciting picture. It could, and there's a lot that you can do scientifically with a photograph. But still, at the end of the day, without any other evidence, that's all it is. And a lot of people might question that. But if you think about it, let's say for example, a couple's out at the beach like that one photograph we were talking about earlier, and let's say they in this order that they do in fact see an anomalous object, or aka a UFO, and then the husband yells to the wife, grab the camera quick, take some shots of that, and they do that, now you have an eyewitness declaration supported by photographic evidence. This opposed to the reverse of just taking scenic shots and then you catch something that you didn't notice, with your eyes later on when you upload it to the computer. Much more, it shores up the photograph in the first example, shores up the anecdotal evidence. And so now you have two sources of evidence. And then, of course, if you pursued it further, if it was called for, I mean, let's say if it was a large structured craft or that kind of thing, then if you pull researchers into it and perhaps you contact local Air Force bases or civilian airports and ask for radar reports, that kind of thing, case in point, Stephenville, we've got the radar reports that not only have they shored up the anecdotal accounts, there were some cell phone shots of it, etc. So in that case, you've got visual radar accounts along with some small photographic evidence. So, the evidence compiles in a case, but each slice of evidence alone is weak. The more that you look into a case and the more that you can compile collateral evidence, the stronger the case gets.
This is true. I can't stress enough how important it is for people it's important for people to report their sightings and, if possible, yes, visual documentation, but digital is so easy to manipulate.
That goes back to where I was saying, particularly nowadays. I mean, anybody, where we are at a personal level for technology, I mean, anybody, some of these kids out there can do pictures and video that are just absolutely fantastic. I mean, it's state-of-the-art stuff. So I really don't put a lot into a photograph by itself. And as you know, I mean, there's things that have just been up recently. For example, that video where there's a UFO in the distance, and or a plane in the distance, rather, and then the UFO comes up and literally looks like it attaches itself to the plane, grabs the plane, and then takes off at a high speed and disappears. That drew a lot of attention, and a lot of people were curious about that. I immediately called it CGI, and then later on, after investigation, the author of that particular video admitted that's in fact what it was. But you have to be skeptical about these things, and because of that, even more so today, a picture by itself is just that. It's just a picture, and it does not. I'm sorry to say, it's not strong evidence in these cases. It goes back to Sagan's old saying, extraordinary statements require extraordinary evidence. I'm ad-libbing his statement, but you get the idea.
Okay, if we could hang on here for just a moment. I've been told that my audio is overpowering you. I'm going to switch headsets here real quick.
Okay.
Pull this one out there. I'm hoping that's much better. I'm getting a thumbs up, so I guess that's going to work. sorry about that, everybody. Okay, can we get a sound check? That way we can tell whether I'm blaring or you're blaring.
Well, I'm here. Now, when you changed, I noticed that your audio to me is lower.
Okay. I will speak up a little bit then.
Okay.
Okay, I think that's going to work.
All righty.
Okay, we're getting word that we're a little more even, so... That's always a good thing. I don't want to blare people's ears out.
You don't want to overmodulate. That's correct.
Oh, no, definitely. Gosh, let's see. I kind of lost my train of thought. I've been reading some of your articles, mm-hmm. and I'm like going, wow, I really, really like this guy. I like the way he thinks.
Well, thank you.
Well, you're welcome.
I like to be liked.
Well, so does everybody, but... I was noticing that you don't focus on any one aspect. You go all the way from UFOs in the news to the future First Lady of Japan and her abduction account and everything in between. Keeps you pretty busy, I take it.
That's a yes and no thing. I have a particular interest in historic events, and I'm personally involved at any given time. I'm involved in Roswell research. I'm involved in Aztec research. The Paradise Valley incident out in your neck of the woods has just been brought to my attention, and I'm neck deep in that at the moment. I've done a lot of research on the Battle of Los Angeles, for example, and I work with I work in concert with various researchers on each specific category. That's my own personal thing. Also with the notion that I believe that our government has become very good at being covert nowadays. Early on, in particular with the onset of what we would deem modern day ufology, say starting with the Kenneth Arnold sighting, or perhaps before, we can go back to the Battle of L.A. in 1942, I don't think they were that good, and a lot of things fell through the cracks. So I spend a lot of time doing historical research, and I thoroughly enjoy it. It's just fascinating. Now, in terms of modern-day things, because of the website, I'm always monitoring things that are going on a day-to-day basis. The thing with the First Lady, or the soon-to-be First Lady of Japan, we were getting bombarded with that. I'm a news junkie, so I always have the news on no matter what I'm doing, and I'm hearing this story. And sad to say, I'm hearing the comical side of the story and all the criticism about it on CNN and MSNBC and all the networks and Fox, etc. And I thought, I'm a big harsh critic of mainstream media anyway, and I thought, here we go again. that, you know, they're going to tear this thing apart and they're going to meld it with ufology in general. And it's just not going to help anything. And as I wrote in that article, you know, you're going to have mainstream media, they're going to just tear apart ufology and go, you know, this lady was taken to Venus, boy, I told you so, ha, ha, ha. And then you're going to get the fringe elements of ufology that are going to embrace this and say, well, this just proves that our space brothers are living among us. And, you know, and here, and this will go on in a news cycle for a couple of days until something takes its place. So I thought, it stirred up a little emotion in me, and when that happens, I try to put pen to paper, or proverbial paper, so to speak, and I did, and just wrote a quick little blurb about it. But that often, you know, that if something catches my attention like that, I try to put pen to paper, and which is one of the reasons I created the website to begin with, aside from collecting UFO reports. It gives me the opportunity to do that because I enjoy writing at this stage of the game, and I also like to host my colleagues' articles, as you well know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you've got an impressive list of individuals who have contributed to the website as well.
I agree. I've got the utmost respect for my colleagues that have taken time to share their thoughts and write an article and so forth. You know, we've got some heavy hitters on there.
Yes, yes. I've had several of them, well, actually quite a few of them as guests here on the show as well.
Well, we both have good taste, it sounds like.
Well, of course. What's the case, I hate using the term case, what project is the most consuming for you right at the moment?
Well, that's a good question because I've got so many oars in the water, so many irons in the fire. The other day, Alejandro Rojas got a hold of me and asked about my research into the Paradise Valley incident. And for those of your listeners that aren't familiar with that, this was first mentioned in Frank Scully's book, Behind the Flying Saucers, that it was about an alleged saucer crash in the Cave Creek area in October of 1947. And I am heavily involved with the Aztec research. In fact, I have been asked to pen a chapter on the infamous Silas Newton for Scott and Suzanne Ramsey in their upcoming book. And I was aware of the Paradise Valley crash, and at the UFO Chronicles, we had published a couple of historic articles on it. But I responded to Alejandro. I said, I really don't think I could tell you any more than you probably already know. But he got my attention with that, and I started to dig into it, and I have been doing so since he sent the email. And it's very, very intriguing. The primary witness is stuck to his guns. And everybody, and I've since interviewed a few people that interviewed him years ago, and everybody that encountered him felt that he was a very credible witness, and they literally believed what he was saying. And Timothy Good, for example, cited him in his book Need to Know, or no, I take that back, not Need to Know. He cited him as far back as Above Top Secret, and. Jim Mars, there was a mention of Jim Mars about that particular, in Jim Mars' book, Alien Agenda, about the incident. And I've been uncovering some things in this, and it's the hook has been set, so to speak. I find it intriguing, and there was a Silas Newton connection. The primary witness was so smitten by what he had seen in 47. He actually sought out Silas Newton, knowing that Newton was the primary source of information for Scully's book. So he had this secretive meeting with Silas Newton in the early 60s. And because I'm writing the chapter on Silas Newton, I thought, well, this is worth pursuing. I'm going to look into this. And it's quite interesting. And I wasn't aware of so much of that up until just the last few weeks.
I can't wait to find out what you come up with, because I've read on both the Aztec incident and also the Paradise Valley incident. In fact, I work not far from Cave Creek,
mm-hmm.
On the proverbial day job. And one of the people I work with lives in Cave Creek and has grown up there.
Mm-hmm.
And I had asked her if she had heard anything about that, and she just kind of looked at me. You know how you get that cockeyed
look. You're in the headlight look, yeah.
Yeah.
Like you grew another head.
Pretty much. And she goes, no, I've never heard anything about it. So, even people who've lived there all their lives or most of their lives don't know anything about it.
Well, I spoke to one of the reporters that interviewed the primary witness about 10 years ago. Well, actually, no, about 12 years ago now, I think. And this guy is he's a mainstream reporter. He's not a ufologist per se in any sense of the word. In fact, he made that very clear when I was talking to him. But he was very, very impressed with the primary witness. And he was intrigued. He was so impressed by the witness, whom he spent a good deal of time with. He point blank told me, he says, I really believe that this incident happened. In fact, he said that, and I went back and corrected him. And I said, basically what you're saying is that you believe that the witness believes that he saw a UFO. And we won't take it any further than that. He and I both clarified that we're talking about an unidentified flying object. He and I both use the term in the verbatim. Unidentified means unidentified. It doesn't mean an alien spacecraft. Obviously, if it's an alien spacecraft, it's not unidentified. It can't be the same thing. But he was impressed with the testimony and the character of the primary witness so much so that he truly believes that this incident took place. And I just find that fascinating, of course. And much like Aztec, and knowing all the work that's been put into Aztec, starting from point A to point B, Scott Ramsey and his lovely wife Suzanne, and it's just meticulous work. They have peeled the layer of the onion back, so to speak, and they've been able to locate these first-hand, second-hand, third-hand witnesses. And knowing the beginning of the trek and realizing that it didn't seem like there was a lot to work with, as they dug in deeper and deeper, it's come to fruition. And they've compiled a great many names of witnesses and interviewed several. And all of this will be in the upcoming book. Hopefully it'll be out in the spring. But I look at that with the same optimism, knowing what's been culled from Aztec, and hopefully we can do the same thing with the Cave Creek Paradise Valley situation.
Any idea what the book's going to be called?
He's run a couple names past me, and I'm not sure. I don't want to speak out of turn for him. But one thing I am, that I can assure you of, it will be a fascinating read.
I'm looking forward to it. You've got me highly intrigued on this one.
Well, you should have him on the show. The work, everybody hangs their hat. Most researchers that are semi-cognizant of Aztec, they hang the whole incident on Scully, Newton, and Gebauer. And the mode of thought is that Scully was hoodwinked by the con man Newton and Gebauer. And I'm here to tell you, you can take those three people out of the picture, and with the work that Scott and Suzanne Ramsey have done, I mean, they don't even have to enter it. The evidence that they have compiled and the witnesses that they will expose in the book is fascinating, as well as physical evidence. And in fact, they just made a trek there over the summer. One of the arguments was, if the craft was as big as it was reported at 100 feet, there's no way that they could move this thing out there. Well, they hired a gentleman who's an expert at moving the largest things on the planet, and they took him out there, and they literally drove the path. They used the old period maps to drive the roads that this allegedly was taken on, and they proved scientifically that, in fact, a craft that large, using vehicles of the time, that this could have been done the way it was written in Scully's book and then later Steinman's book. So Scott's taken a scientific approach to a lot of this, and one of the other things is that there was, early on, it was found that there was a concrete pedestal out there, and the notion was that because of the silty sand, they had to bring a crane in, and for support, they had to pour these concrete footings. Well, he's had that concrete analyzed and to get the timeline on it, and it, in fact, does fit the 1948 timeline. So he's done a lot of scientific evidence in addition to interviewing direct eyewitnesses, secondhand witnesses, and family members, etc. It's going to be fascinating. It's groundbreaking stuff.
Oh, I have an interesting question here that was sent to me to ask you.
Shoot.
This is we have our virtual audience in our virtual auditorium in Palpok, and we get some really good questions from them. This is from Gossamer 777.
Dee, can you speak up just a little bit? I'm having
certainly. I got so used to talking quietly. This is from Gossamer 777,
okay.
And he asks, I have heard rumors that the Battle of L.A. UFO was shot down and that it went down off the coast of California and was recovered by the Navy. Have you heard anything about this in your investigation of the Battle of L.A.?
Well, the short answer is yes, but I haven't seen I haven't seen concrete evidence to shore that up. There were I have run reports where not the craft, but basically what was thought to be an airplane going down. One thing that people that have looked into the Battle of L.A., one thing that there's confusion in terms of whether our airplanes were up or not. I'm here to tell you we had planes in the air, and we would have been derelict of duty had we not. The powers that be at the time denied that. Actually, the naval faction and the army factions were at odds of each other because they were trying to cover this thing up. But you have to understand the flavor of the times. We were just attacked at Pearl Harbor just 3 months earlier. And one of the, I mean, we, pardon the phrase, but we got caught with our pants down. And we were expecting a West Coast attack at any given moment. The day before, we had the I-17, a Japanese sub, lob shells at Goleta, which was unsuccessful for the most part. But, at that point, we were expecting a major West Coast attack. When this object came over, I can guarantee you, in fact, we interviewed eyewitnesses to the effect, our planes were, in fact, in the air. We would have been derelict of duty not having planes in the air. We were under the assumption that the West Coast was under attack, and we were not going to let the same thing happen as was the case with Pearl Harbor. And this explains, many people said, we saw all these objects, we saw lights. Now add to the event that we've got 3-inch anti-aircraft rounds going off. When it got down to Fort MacArthur, they had 5-inch guns there that actually shot at the craft. You've got pure pandemonium happening, and the people that are under this, we're under blackout. People are in their houses. They're told to keep their shades down. This is happening at the middle of the night. We people literally assume that we're under attack by the Japanese. So you've got a lot of, crazy stuff going on, but there are planes in the air, and then, of course, we have this huge object, the elliptical-shaped UFO that came in from the west, came in up the coast, and then came out and then went out through Long Beach, which was controlled. A lot of people, some of the debunkers have gotten in there and said, well, that had to be a balloon or this kind of thing. Well, we know the flight path of this thing, and it was under control. This thing just didn't, go with the wind, for example. And it took direct hits from 3-inch anti-aircraft rounds for several hours. It was over 1,500 3-inch anti-aircraft rounds fired at this thing. And if you look at the infamous picture of the Battle of L.A. that donned the newspaper the next day of the Los Angeles Times, which, by the way, I introduced that photograph to the Internet a few years back, well, several years back now, That picture shows the object being hit directly with 3-inch anti-aircraft rounds, and there is nothing in our inventory, when I say our inventory, I mean man's inventory, that could withstand a 3-inch anti-aircraft round then, an object that it might possibly fall under, like a dirigible, for example, or now. You know, we did have things that large. Our research indicates that the object was over 800 feet wide, and we did have things that big, like the Macon and the Akron dirigibles. But one 3-inch anti-aircraft round would have taken either one of those down, or anything like it, any blimp-type dirigible. One 3-inch anti-aircraft round, and that would have been over, much less hundreds.
I have seen on both on the Internet and on documentaries on TV what looks, you know, that photograph that you're talking about. Plus, I'm not sure whether it was newsreel footage, because they would show news in the theaters, before the movie would start. They'd have the movie tone news.
Mm-hmm.
And it looked like that quality film, actual footage of this going off. Was I seeing incorrectly, or was that...
Yeah, there's one video that's floating out there that was made, but there is no video of the Battle of Los Angeles event. There has been a video made, which makes it look like there was an actual video, but there's no video of the Battle of Los Angeles event. I will say that there are other photographs, but none of them have been publicized.
Oh, there are
more
photographs.
There are, yeah. Well, and this goes back, you asked me that I seem to be all over the place in my research. There's a couple of cases that are ongoing that I do work on and have worked on for years, and the Battle of Los Angeles is one of them.
Interesting. And you also mentioned, too, that you're like myself, an aficionado a looker into of the Roswell incident. I hear a lot of people talking about this nitinol, claiming it's a memory metal,
mm-hmm.
A la Roswell. But I have to keep reminding people it's close, but not quite, because this nitinol needs a heat source or hot water,
mm-hmm.
as the way I saw it demonstrated, to go back to its original shape. The memory metal from Roswell, you just crumble it up and let go of it, and it went back into its own shape, or original
well,
shape.
Well, the notion with the nitinol, or nitinol, whichever way you pronounce it, it goes back to the idea that perhaps the items from the Roswell crash were back engineered. And the work that Tony Bregaglia has been doing, and I get asked this question a lot, what do you make of Tony Bregaglia's work? And he's kind enough to let us publish every article that he writes on these events, and we're happy to do so. My short answer to that is the fact that his work gives me pause, and it necessitates further research. He's pulled up some very, very interesting things. He's pulled up some documents. His FOIA inquiries have come to fruition. He's pulled some information on some of these scientists. He's been able to track down a couple guys. I find this very fascinating. Now, is this a smoking gun? No. But it's certainly, it looks like we're looking at bullets. And it necessitates further research. And by the same token, this is this really got Billy Cox fired up, and he's done some FOIA work under this same umbrella, in the path of Bregaglia's work, and he's come up with some interesting things. And this is what needs to happen. We need to look into these things when we find out, when we find new information. So I applaud Tony Bregaglia's work. I think it's great. And he's got more to come. He's working on a couple other things, and you know, pay attention because he's got some exciting stuff coming. I'm looking forward to seeing further research on that.
Yeah, I just received a follow-up question concerning the Battle of Los Angeles from the same person. It says, there is a letter to J. Edgar Hoover where someone asks if the FBI will investigate UFOs. And he responds by saying that the FBI would insist on cursory examination of any objects recovered. And he mentions an incident in 1942 where the military recovered an object and wouldn't let the FBI look at it. Have you heard of this letter, and do you think he is referring to the Battle of Los Angeles object?
That, I'm going to assume that that's a little bit of melded information. Hoover did in fact write a letter using that verbiage exactly, and the authentic letter was in reference to an incident that happened in Louisiana. And where the confusion exists is that he used the acronym LA for Louisiana, and people assumed it was Los Angeles. However, it was for 1947, 1942. And the incident that happened in Louisiana was a hoax. It was with a little disc that was, you know, like a 1 or 2 feet in diameter. Now, the importance of the letter is that they were taking this, the FBI and all the powers that be at the time, were taking this thing very, very seriously. However, Hoover didn't want to be the military's puppy dog. The military at the time, and bear in mind, you have to understand the flavor of the times, all the separate military organizations, you know, the Army, the Navy, the Army Air Force, and then later on the Air Force, they were like puppies at the food dish. They were very competitive with each other, and they didn't like to share information. So consequently, they're all trying to figure out what's flying in our airspace, and they tasked the FBI to be, you know, the go-after agency. Go in and interview these people. Any of the big stuff we'll handle. Well, that kind of, pardon my French, but that pissed Hoover off, and he wasn't going to have any of it. He said, you know, we want to be equal puppies at the food dish here, and, you know, we're not going to do this unless we're heavily involved. But that one specific letter was about the event that happened in Louisiana, not Los Angeles, and it was in 1947, not 1942.
Interesting. I knew quite a bit about that memo. It was actually a memo, and he had just handwritten across the bottom.
Well, sadly, what happens, I'm being presumptuous, but you know, you get fringe elements out there, and they take authentic documents, and you know, and they make documents out of it, and then things get muddled, dates get confused, you know, et cetera. Not to say that the person in the chat room did anything like that, but I mean that it, you know, it floats around the internet like that, and then pretty soon you can't tell the authentic documents from bogus documents, that kind of thing.
This is true. Something a little more current, or to us anyway. There's this individual who claims that the Rendlesham Forest incident of December of 1980.
Mm-hmm.
Was in fact a truck of his that he had loaned to a friend,
mm-hmm.
who had went and stole some fertilizer, and they were trying to burn it to hide the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I see you finding that as humorous and silly as I am.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, what? It's just ludicrous. You know, when I think of something like that, it for some reason it makes me think of James Magaha, or Magehe, or however you pronounce his name. But you just want to ask somebody, are you really serious? You know, I don't know. It's not even worth time to waste. It's absolutely ridiculous. Anybody that if somebody's just done a cursory examination into the Rendlesham event, they realize how silly that is. It's just absolutely nuts, you know.
it must have been one heck of a large load of fertilizer.
Well, I think the person that's brought that to our attention is spouting a bunch of fertilizer, quite frankly.
Oh gosh, yeah, you're thinking the same terminology I am, but
well, I mean, there's
this
something,
is a G-rated program.
You know, there's some things that that will give you pause and that need to be discussed. This just doesn't happen to be one of them. It's just it's reminiscent of Bill Nye, the last time he was, or actually his first appearance on the Larry King show. You wanted to grab Larry King and go, what the hell are you thinking? What is this guy on here for? Why don't you just put a mannequin? He has no clue about ufology. And I just thought, oh, I felt sorry for Bill Nye. I thought, my God, this guy is so unprepared to be the other side of the UFO discussion. I thought, oh, my God, this is just ridiculous. It's very much like this manure deal.
I agree. I used to like Bill Nye. I think the program he did, you know, explaining science stuff to kids was wonderful. I mean, my daughter loved it, and she wasn't really went into the sciences. She just thought this guy was a lot of fun and made science interesting for kids. But the moment he opened his mouth on that program, I lost all respect for him.
Well, it's a pure example of what I call cognitive bias. I mean, here's an intelligent man, and he's made a living off of heralding science, and yet when he comes on to discuss a topic that he's unfamiliar with, he leaves science at home. And I thought, what, you know, here's, look at the irony in this. It's like, where are your scientific ethics, for God's sakes? I mean, you know, the very first, people forget that the very first step in scientific methodology is the observance of a phenomenon. Nobody in their right mind is going to deny the fact that ufology, UFOs, that phenomenon has not been observed, for one thing, and scientific methodology demands that we look into it. That's science at its core. But cognitive bias that's exhibited by people such as Bill Nye, they just dismiss it. And they throw science by the wayside all of a sudden. And I just, you know, the irony that's in that is, it's pathetic, quite frankly.
Well, and then the other irony in that is his cohort, I guess you could say, on that particular program, Seth Shostak, who's the head of the SETI program, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. This guy makes his living from looking for ETs, but yet he doesn't think that there's, you know, any possibility that they could be visiting us already.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that just, to me, that just is asinine.
Well, one of the things that Shostak has done, and I wrote a couple pieces on it, one of the times that he debated Stan Friedman, he said in public, he says, look, I'm no ufologist. I haven't really looked into these things deeply. And I thought, look, that's like critiquing a book that you haven't read. How scientific is that? Basically what he's saying is I have no right to an opinion. Then later on in a Larry King show, he argued the point that he did, in fact, even though he knew little, and he said this in one sentence, which I couldn't believe. He said, first off, he's admitting that he hasn't looked into the subject matter deeply, but still he feels he has the right to be able to comment on it. And I thought, well, you know, my God, that would be like having a physics conversation and somebody making asinine statements about it and not having any inkling about physics whatsoever. Or to use another analogy, it would be like talking about trigonometry when the student hasn't even reached algebra yet. It doesn't make sense. That's crazy. And in any other scientific scenario, he'd be laughed out of the room. That's just absolutely nuts.
I agree.
And sadly, the other question is, why does Larry King feel that he needs the so-called skeptic on there? I mean, you know, when he interviews a preacher or a reverend, you know, is there an atheist? Is it required to have an atheist or an agnostic on along with him? No. And, of course, that is a belief system. That is a matter of faith. That is a faith-based topic. So how come it's not a requirement to have an atheist or an agnostic on with a reverend if you're talking about a religious topic? And this is something that people just take for granted. I mean, let's face it. God is the biggest ET of all. And this is purely faith-based. And admittedly, it's agreeably faith-based. With UFOs, we're talking about a factual thing, which, by the way, I have to remind people of all the time, that the term UFO was born by, the acronym was born by the Air Force in 1952 to describe the objects that were flying all over our airspace for the previous 5 years. In fact, it took the place, the acronym UFO, interestingly took the place of the term flying saucer. So we went from calling it an object that actually described what it was, these nuts and bolts craft, to saying it's something that we don't know what it is, an unidentified flying object, which I thought was very interesting for the public psyche at the time. But this, you know, this was a military term. And when people associate the noun believer or the verb believe with UFOs, I cringe. I go, look, let's don't associate, don't make this faith-based. We're talking about factual things here. You know, to use the term believe or the noun believer with UFOs, it's like saying, it would be akin to saying, look, there's the group of Mount Rushmore believers, or I believe in the Empire State Building. All those statements are nonsensical. But people take that, they don't think about what they're thinking. They're incorrectly associating the acronym UFO with an extraterrestrial craft, and we have to differentiate between these two. If it's an extraterrestrial craft, we know what it is, therefore it can't be a UFO. And I often tell people, particularly, I was very proud of James Fox and Nick Pope the other day on the Larry King Show with that little short 15-minute stint that they did there with Seth Shostak. They didn't dive into the deep end of the pool. I always tell people you have to do this. When you're dealing with a broad audience, you have to do this in baby steps. Don't dive into the deep pool. Don't talk about the Confederation and all the other alien species out in the universe. Stick with UFOs. This is something that can't be denied. And if you saw that episode, it gave Seth Shostak no place to go. In fact, it actually made him look a little silly because he opened up his regular debunker's playbook and he started talking about these things that Nick and James weren't talking about. They cited factual UFO cases supported by strong evidence. They didn't get into the alien end of things. They stuck with UFOs, and Shostak had no place to go. He had to agree with them because there's no denying the existence of UFOs. And I thought that show was just fantastic, although many of my brethren didn't, and I argued the points. I said, look, this was smart thinking on both of their parts. And in fact, in that particular episode, Nick looked at Shostak and said, I would love to see ufologist and SETI work together. And there again, Shostak was dumbfounded. And he, you know, Nick says, why don't we, let's look at our commonalities. We do agree that there exists, that there is extraterrestrial life in the universe. Why don't we start there and work together? And I thought that was just fantastic. Which is the way it should be, by the way.
And on that note, we need to head for a break. That first hour went by really quick.
Yes, it did.
Okay, and we'll be back here in about 11 minutes on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network with Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis.
Welcome to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis. Now here's your host, DeAndrew.
And welcome back to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network also broadcast live on UPRN 105.5 New Orleans. I'm your host, DeAndrew, and tonight we're talking with Frank Warren. Frank, just before we went to the break, I was sent another question. Oh, well, not sent, but it was a question that was posted in our virtual auditorium that I thought was very relevant. And I wanted to ask it, for Salim Salaram, I believe is how it's pronounced.
Mm-hmm.
And they asked, what does he believe is the significance of the UFO phenomenon in regards to humanity and where we are going as a whole into the future?
Wow. Well, that's a heavy question, isn't it?
Mm.
I don't, well, based on my own research, I believe that UFOs, in fact, I uphold the extraterrestrial hypothesis. I do believe that some UFOs, out of the bulk of UFO reports, are indeed extraterrestrial. Furthermore, I believe they've been here as long as mankind has been on the planet, or what we know to be man. Having said that, over time, it appears that man as a whole has not been cognizant of that fact. We have various mythologies, which I also believe explains a lot of UFO activity, and not only of craft, but of beings, etc. But it does not appear that mankind as a whole has acknowledged that presence, that there, in fact, are extraterrestrials as we would perceive them today. So the question, I think the significance will be, will that event ever happen? Will there be disclosure, for example? And I was asked this question the other day, and I really don't think disclosure, in fact, I think Nick Pope said it, I think he said it in James Fox's upcoming film, I Know What I Saw, which, by the way, I've reviewed in its entirety, and it's absolutely fantastic for your listeners. Everybody's going to love it. It's going to come out in October. He said disclosure is, as we know it, will come out in snippets, and I think he's absolutely correct in that regard. I don't think, for example, in contrast, you know, President Obama is not going to come out and have a big televised event and say, guess what, you know, we've been visited not only lately but for thousands of years. I think events are going to happen that can't be denied, and quite frankly, they are happening. And based on, because of man's personal technology, the advancement in man's personal technology, things can't be denied. We now have instant personal communication on a worldwide basis. I can transmit something to somebody in France in the blink of an eye, and this is relatively new technology. Everybody's walking around with a digital recording device on their hip. When events happen, we can now capture them on a personal level and share that information on a global level. This is unprecedented. So things are not only going to happen, they have happened. I mean, we've had some major events, if you think about it, just recently. Stephenville, for example. O'Hare before that. You know, one thing about UFOs, they don't go away. And I often tell people this, regardless of what you think about it, UFOs don't go away. Things continue to happen and will continue to happen. Our history bears this out. So eventually, as these things continue to happen, the main consensus, man will come around and say, hey, something's going on. And I think that will have profound effects on society as a whole. I hope that we will see that in our lifetimes. But I deem it, it's going to happen one way or the other.
I don't see a lot of the don't get me wrong, I think the work that a lot of, well, one in particular, Stephen Bassett, has been doing, to bring it out into the public eye and into the political end of it. I think he's doing a wonderful job of it. But whether anything comes out of it is anybody's guess. I don't see it coming. I'm like you. I don't see it coming from the Oval Office at all.
Yeah, I don't. That's not going to happen. Not in that regard. And unless something monumental takes place that where the powers that be are forced into a situation. And even then, I mean, you got to think of some of the things that have taken place. I mean, if you go back to O'Hare, for example, you can take the UFO end of it out of that. We had we're in a post 9/11 world. We had an unidentified aircraft in the second busiest airport in the world, and they did not overtly take this. The powers that be did not take this seriously. And to me, it's a safety issue first and foremost. You know, take the UFO stigma away from it. And you have to think that somebody, in fact, did take it seriously. They just didn't do so in an overt or public way. I mean, we just don't know about it. But we're in a 9/11 world. You would have to. I mean, that's what that's what we have the Air Force for example. I mean, we know shortly after 9/11, everything that was flying around was being monitored. Given the fact that our enemies used our own aircraft against us. So you just have to assume that they looked into this just on a safety level. I mean, two brand new organizations were created after 9/11 that monitor our interior airspace. So anything that's pervious to radar is being watched, and which harkens back to Stephenville. And the proof is in the pudding with the work that was done there in retrieving the radar reports.
I agree. And then there was an incident in, I believe it was Kokomo, Indiana, where a whole section of road was blocked off. According to the police, they thought it was an aircraft had went down.
Exactly. Huh? Yeah, we hosted the 911 tapes out of that. That's actually at the UFO Chronicle. In fact, I wrote a long article for Alien Worlds magazine. I was one of the writers for that before the magazine met its demise, and did a lot of research into that. And quite frankly, I believe that Kokomo would have been equal to the Stephenville incident in regards to public or media, the mainstream media attention, had there not been an earthquake within 72 hours. Because the similarities between the two were phenomenal.
I was unaware of the earthquake.
Oh, yeah. There was an earthquake within 72 hours right there in the middle of the country, and that that took the news cycle. And then the Kokomo incident went to the wayside. Otherwise, I think every time that you talked about Stephenville, you'd be talking about Kokomo had that not happened. Lack of a better term or a very accurate term, we had a UFO event. We had the military involved. We had the military deny that they were involved. You had all these emergency vehicles and whatnot, and agencies show up. We've got 911 tapes, eyewitness accounts, debris falling from the sky, jets, military jets out of the MOA breaking the speed of sound. They were chasing something, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, the similarities are mind-boggling. And, you know, and had that earthquake not happened, I think it would be Lincoln and Cadillac. Anytime you mention Stephenville, you'd mention Kokomo. And then, of course, if you mention Stephenville, you have to go back to the Phoenix Lights. The similarities there are mind-boggling. I remember interviewing Steve Allen early on, and when he was describing the event to me, particularly what he witnessed, and then when the object was coming back the other way, and he said when it increased in speed, the white lights turned to red. And I thought, wait a minute, I've heard that before. And I dug up in my old Phoenix Lights file to the early MUFON report, specifically with Richard Motzer, and he had an eyewitness account by a couple that said the same thing about the Phoenix Lights craft. They said when it sped up, the white lights turned red. And I thought, isn't that interesting? Huge V-shaped craft. Huge, possibly V-shaped craft seen in Stephenville years later. Military involved, military chasing it, et cetera, et cetera. You have to ask the question: Is this the same craft, same type of craft?
Valid point. Another question that just came in asks, does the guest feel that some of the mass sightings, such as Stevens Hill, Phoenix Lights, etc., seem planned? There doesn't seem to be a logical reason for such a large craft to show up so low in the sky except for the purpose of being seen.
You know, that's a good question. And I try to be very scientific about my research, and that's not to say I'm a scientist, but I can follow scientific protocol. And I wrote a piece years ago called Alien Intent and Human Explication. And what the thesis of that was is I don't believe that there is enough data on the table without inserting a big if to make assumptions about alien intent by human explication. You know, we don't know, of course, we can stipulate because we do believe, in fact, that bodies have been recovered, et cetera, et cetera. But I personally, I don't know if these are carbon-based entities. Are they mechanical beings? Are they robots? Are they cyborgs? Are these beings that we hear about, are they in fact carbon-based? If we go further than that, this intelligent life, are they societal? Do they think like us? Do they act like us? Do they have to eat? I mean, there's so many questions that you'd have to ask. I just don't think there's enough data on the table, for us to speculate without inserting the big if. A good friend of mine the other day, well, Mike Fortson, in fact, a very dear friend of mine, primary witness to the Phoenix Lights and whom I call the reluctant ufologist, he feels that the craft in relationship to the Phoenix Lights purposely made themselves be seen. And there is some other evidence that's not too public that where he makes a good argument. However, I disagree with that in the sense, from a strict scientific point of view, that there's not enough data, to jump off that cliff. We can only speculate from a human standpoint, and we don't know enough about our alleged extraterrestrial friends. There's not enough data on the table to know what makes them tick. In fact, I've joked with colleagues that you know for all we know they're here to eat our dirt. There's not enough data on the table to make a strong hypothesis with that. It's got to be pure speculation. You have to put the big if in there. You know, if they're like us, if they're carbon based, if they're societal, if they have emotions, for example. And then again, it's just pure speculation. I like to take a Star Trekian point of view on all this. I would hope that there is some confederation out there with benevolent beings, that have evolved past killing each other and so forth and so on. But there's just not enough data on the table to support that at the time being.
Very valid point on that. And speaking of Fortson, you're going to be interviewing him as a guest host on Angela Joyner's program, The Joyner Report, here soon.
That's true. Yeah, looking forward to that.
And when will that be so that our listeners can
we're going
tune
to do
in?
That on the 18th, I believe. Yeah, Angela will be speaking in Tennessee, and she has graciously asked me to guest host. And I really, really appreciate that, and I appreciate her confidence in me for doing that. And I'll be her first guest host, I suppose.
Yes, you will be. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun.
The work that Fortson's done is, I think, awesome. I can't wait to see the finished product.
I was defending his honor today to an individual, ironically, to a hardcore skeptic. He's done a lot of great work. And, the event has literally changed his life. And you mentioned something. I was actually going to draw on a Fortson comment. You talking about taking photographs and whatnot. When he recounts his experience and seeing the huge V-shaped craft. He said he was just frozen. He said, I didn't go get a camera. He said, I didn't take my eyes off of this thing. He said, I was just so in awe of what I was seeing. He said, I didn't want to miss it. I didn't want to miss a beat. And I have found that that's a commonality of eyewitnesses to up-close and personal UFOs. You're frozen. You are so in awe of what you're looking at, you don't want to go anywhere. I mean, common sense, somewhere in your brain, your makeup, you know, it's telling you, you know, get some proof, get some evidence of this, go grab the camera. But you're just so in awe of it, you don't move. As he stated time and time again.
Yeah, I can relate on that. The first sighting I had, there was my daughter and my neighbor and I standing there just watching this thing. And I had been standing there watching it for about a minute, and I thought, oh, you dummy, go get the camera. Mm. You know, and by the time I went in, got the camera, and changed lenses on it, because it was, you know, frankly, it wasn't a good lens to take a picture of this object that was, I'm guessing, about 5 miles away, and got back outside, it was too late.
Mm.
You know, so I can understand his point. You know, you don't want to take your eyes off. You don't want to miss a single detail.
Over the years, we finally had a sighting, my wife and I. This has been a few years back, because people always ask me, has your research, was it precipitated by a sighting of your own? And my answer has always been no, but I did have a sighting, and it, quite frankly, it wasn't that significant. I don't get too excited by distant objects in the sky. However, we did have one. We were going to the show. It was date day, and I caught something out of the corner of my eye driving down the road. It was broad daylight, and we were going to a matinee, and I saw this cylindrical shaped object, and I told my wife, I said, you know, I'm driving, keep an eye on that thing. And we were both puzzled by what it was. The best way to describe it, it looked like a flying beer can, a silver or aluminum in color, no markings, no nothing, no details on it. I pulled into the parking lot of the theater. I got out, I locked onto it, and I was trying to get into a better position, and I went through some trees to get on the other side and looked back up in the same spot, and it was gone, and it was a cloudless day. Now, I don't know what it was, and I scanned the skies, and it was fairly, if you were to hold a quarter at arm's length, it was probably the size of a ping pong ball, and it was just hovering, for lack of a better description, and in the span of maybe 5 seconds, it was gone, and I don't know if it sped away, or it just wasn't there anymore, but that was my one and only UFO sighting.
It gets exciting when you see that there, don't you?
It was a little exciting. It was, again, I'm not, had that thing landed in the parking lot, I really got excited.
Well,
but I've done so much research, the long and distant sightings just don't do that much for me.
Oh, gosh, the adrenaline was just like coursing through me the first sighting I had.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question here from Sandman 137, and he asks, what does the guest think about one world peace in respect to extraterrestrial intervention?
Wow, another deep question. Boy, these are good questions. It just makes me think of John Lennon and this, you know, his song, Let's Give Peace a Chance. I unfortunately, I feel it's a pipe dream, but, you know, by all means, isn't that something we should, that should be a goal? It should always be a goal, regardless of the ET factor. One would hope that if the public mindset was as of earthlings rather than split nations and ideologies, that perhaps we could come together as one, as earthlings, as one unit in one peaceful mindset. We can only pray that's how things would work out. And I mean, in my fantasies, that's the way it works.
Oh, here's another good one. This one's from Dimensional Star, and he asks, how do we see the UFO extraterrestrial subject evolving over the next 5 years?
I think that goes back in part to the answer to the previous listener's question. I think events will continue because man's personal technology has evolved to such a degree. Things can't be denied. You know, the old, it was swamp gas story by the powers that be aren't going to wash anymore. I mean, when an event takes place and, you know, 500 people take pictures of it with their cell phone cameras, it's hard to deny these events. And as I've always said, no matter what any of us think about UFOs, they don't go away. They keep coming back, and events continue to happen. And sometimes events happen, and they don't get publicized. I was talking to a good friend and our lonely mainstream ufologist reporter, Billy Cox, the other day, and I had mentioned, I'm addicted to the counter on the UFO Chronicles website and the information it records, and we oftentimes have many government military ISPs that will peruse the site, and periodically, about three or four times, we've been overrun by government and military ISPs for various articles. One in particular was when we first published Scott Ramsey's Aztec articles, the Aztec crash in 1948. I had literally dozens of Air Force ISPs that went straight to that story and nowhere else. And that happened not quite as severe the second when we published an addendum to that original story. Then we published a story about a UFO crash in Africa, I think it was 2007. And that went around the world. That got heavy exposure for about 72 hours and went black. All the news channels picked it up. An airplane actually saw it. It came very, very close to hitting an aircraft. And when that took place and we published those articles, I had NASA, I had the DOD, I had six or seven scientific lab ISPs that went straight to those articles, you know, for like Sandia and Lawrence Livermore Laboratories, places like that. I had the Canadian DOD, and they all went straight to that article and nowhere else. And I was talking to an associate about that, and he said, well, that's probably just a happenstance thing. They were just perusing the website. I said, no. I said, listen, I monitor this thing. It's like a drug. I said, there's math behind this. I can tell when somebody's just, perusing the website, kind of surfing the Internet. I said, there's science behind this, and it's called mathematics. These people, in fact, the government ISPs, they were stacked up on top of each other minutes apart. Now, I can't tell you why they went to that article and what attracted to them, but I can tell you it wasn't an accident. And these events, they're going to continue like that. And the larger events like Stephenville and O'Hare, they'll continue to go on, and they eventually, because of man's individual technology, they won't be able to be denied. I mean, let's face it, we're a force united on the Internet, for example. I mean, the Internet really is the new news source, and we can broadcast news instantaneously around the world when these things happen. So we've kind of taken the power away from the powers that be, so to speak. So we're almost, in a sense, doing this on our own, regardless of what the powers, regardless of the obstacles that are in the way. So I think I'm optimistic. I think things will come out because they'll be forced to come out. An official response will have to take place because of major events that will take place.
You know, I'm happy to find out my site's not the only one that gets hits from the government, and I get, oh gosh, I've had hits from, I can't remember the name of the company right now, but it is part of the Battelle Institute, one of their laboratories in Fort Belvoir, Virginia. Mm-hmm. And if you being a history of ufology, you know the significance of Fort Belvoir.
Mm-hmm.
And all that. And, it just blows me away. It just like, okay, guys, go ahead. You need me to keep you informed. I'm okay with it. Go for it.
Yeah, and I hope you record all those ISPs.
Actually, yes, we have been.
Good.
I have another question.
I've got hundreds of them.
Well, I don't have quite that many, but they do pop up once in a while. I have another question here for you. There seems to be an increase of mainstream media coverage of the UFO topic and sightings, etc. Some people say any coverage of the UFO topic by mainstream media is good, even if it is reported with lots of giggle factor. Do you agree?
No, I disagree. I do not believe that any information broadcast is a good thing. In fact, I think it's hurtful. And quite frankly, not only just for mainstream media, I was not a fan of UFO hunters. In fact, I was probably one of their biggest critics and was asked to be on the show, by the way, and politely refused to go on. But I don't think it's helpful. I've often said that the strongest thing on the planet is the media and those who pull their strings. Let's face it, we are a society that is instructed by what we see on that medium. Our mindsets are literally, there's actually a little bit of mind control going on if you get into the scientific end of it. I mean, they did a poll early on after the invasion of Iraq where they thought that Saddam Hussein still had something to do with 9/11. In fact, there's people today that still believe that because of the brainwashing effect of what goes on with the media. So, no, I vehemently disagree that any news from the media or any attention given to ufology is a good thing. Just the opposite, in fact. But now, having said that, I believe that it's upon us, and when I say us, I mean ufologists in general, that we have to get and get good salient information to the media. And a good case in point was that's one of the reasons I was so proud of Nick Pope and James Fox the other night on Larry King. They hit Larry with good salient evidence, strong evidence, good cases. They stuck with ufology. They didn't jump into the deep end of the pool. They let the in-house skeptic, Seth Shostak, nowhere to go. He opened up his regular debunker's playbook, and he was making arguments that it didn't even come up. I mean, it literally made him look silly. That's the type or at least in the Larry King end of it, that's the type of media attention that we need. We need good, sober ufologists to represent ufology. The Hastings episode, when Robert Hastings and Bob Salas were on Larry King, another great episode. Or docu-style UFO shows. Good friend and producer Dwayne Tootle is working on some things right now, and hopefully that'll come to fruition, and we will see a future good UFO show. He was had a heavy hand in the UFO Files episode, which I was really fond of. And that's the kind of work that we need to see on television. We need to take this topic seriously. And it's in our hands to manipulate the media, so to speak, and assert the fact that they need to take it seriously.
So on the other side of the coin, then, if there's no giggle factor involved, that it's a straightforward, you know, serious report. Do you see that as a good thing?
Yes, most definitely, certainly. You know, you have to remember that early on, the media was one of the reasons that the powers that be got involved. That's one of the reasons that Blue Book came to be. This was front page news in the late 40s and early 50s. I believe that the mindset of the media and, that, quite frankly, society in general is an after effect of decades of debunking the topic. And I don't believe it was done on purpose. I think it was a side effect. We know that the powers that be early on after the Robertson panel meeting and, quite frankly, before that, took an active effort in debunking UFO sightings. Well, consequently, this created a mindset that permeated the media, and then this is where you get the wink-winks and the nods and the pokes and the ribs, and they don't take this thing seriously. This is not how this was, when modern-day ufology was born, say, from the Kenneth Arnold sighting on. This was front-page news. I mean, the largest press meeting after World War II was in 1952, in the summer of 52, when all the UFOs were being seen, in Washington, D.C., and in close proximity to the White House. That was big, serious business. But gradually, as the powers that be, and bear in mind that we had an active Air Force investigation into UFO reports, because of the ongoing efforts to debunk all these things, that kind of calloused the media. And as generations passed, then it reverses itself. Rather than take it seriously, it's a joke. It becomes a joke. But I truly believe that was a side effect of debunking the subject for decades.
Oh, here's another deep question. This one's going to be good.
What an audience you have.
This one says, some people think any real answers as to what the UFO ET phenomenon is all about will come from abductees and contactees. There are some good, credible stories, but there are even more nonsensical stuff from want-to-be contactees and people who just want their 15 minutes of fame. Do you think we can actually gain some useful information from the genuine abductees?
You know, that's another great question. And quite frankly, the short answer to that is yes. But I think it will be done in a covert way rather than an overt way. And because of the media factor, when these things get publicized, I mean, let's face it, case in point, just recently, the ABC show that they did a couple of weeks ago.
Outsiders?
Yeah, the Outsiders show. I mean, it was absolutely ridiculous. It was biased, etc. And that's what we're going to get in a public matter. Important minutiae can be culled from abductees, but I think it will be done on a private scale with ufologists and people, that are involved specifically with the abduction phenomenon. There might be information out there right now that it's just not, for public fodder. And I've oftentimes said that ufology needs an agent. There's things that we can do as investigators amongst ourselves, but we also have to have a public face, and that we have fringe elements in ufology that are not helping. And of course, I mean, there's fringe elements in everything, but we have to, in order to be taken seriously, depending on what our goals are, much of the goal is to have a government body come back in and officially investigate the UFO phenomenon. And that may or may not, some people may disagree with that, but there is one benefit about having an ongoing government investigation. It frees up the scientists. Scientists aren't so standoffish to talk about the topic. And let's face it, there's a whole bunch of scientists out there that are very interested in the topic. They just don't want to say so publicly. So if the government has an official investigative body looking into the matter, then that that eases the tension on individual scientists. They're more free to talk about it. So that, if nothing, that would be a great thing all by itself, to have a government body come back and investigate it, a la Project Blue Book.
Well, here's an interesting comment, not a question, but a comment that I'd like to hear your thoughts about. This is from Linda Keeper, and she says, the world will not take this subject seriously until we ourselves treat it seriously. Some of the worst press comes because of famous ufologists, ambassadors, and UFO festivals.
Well, that kind of goes along with what we've just been talking about. Yeah, that's true. There's the media likes to pick up on the woo-woo end of things. And Yeah, I mean, we can talk about the Roswell Festival, for example, and I completely understand what's going on, and the Roswell Festival is a very positive financial thing for the city of Roswell, and I get that. But many sober ufologists cringe to the carnival atmosphere. And sometimes you just can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. And there's a situation where you have to say, well, you know, do you just throw the whole thing out or do you participate? Most have chosen to participate. But when, you know, when the media picks up on the Roswell Festival, for example, do they go to the hardcore research and look at some of the talks that were done by, you know, quality researchers? Generally, they skip past that and they show everybody dressed up as an alien and, you know, people wearing tinfoil hats and that kind of thing. That's the sad part about it. But what do you do? Do you give up the whole thing and not do it? Sadly, the answer is, you know, I mean, it's of course not. You have to do it. And hope, you know, for those of us that take the serious approach and are serious ufologists, we're looking at the serious speakers, what they're bringing to the table. As you mentioned, this year we had a new witness come out. That was important. Unfortunately, the media, for the most part, that's not their focus. They want the woo-woo end of things.
They want the giggle factor.
Exactly.
Okay, we got another one from Gossamer 777. He said, someone mentioned mass sightings a while ago, and I was wondering, do you think we are about due for another mass sighting somewhere? Sometimes such events seem to me to be almost an on a timetable of sorts.
Well, you know, it has been proven that there are, in fact, waves. In fact, I've looked back, and it almost seems like every 5 years there are waves. But you can go back in the data, and there are, you know, there are peaks and valleys. And my short answer is yes, I do believe these events are going to continue and big events will happen. And a lot of it has to do, I hate to repeat myself, but it's because of our personal technology. Things can't be denied. You know, you get you get people, well, a prime example, there was another event in Stephenville at a football game. And you had a jet chasing a UFO. Angela Joyner wrote about it. How are you going to debunk a whole football stadium full of eyewitnesses? Many with cell phone cameras. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think it's going to go on. So.
I do too. I mean, that's something that had been noticed back in the 50s and the 60s of the frequency of flaps.
And for your listeners and the people in Pal Talk, I think I finally got to the Pal Talk room, but I have no clue what I'm doing. So if anybody's trying to reach out, and I'm not ignoring you, I literally just downloaded Pal Talk while we were on the air, so I don't know what I'm doing yet.
Have we noticed your name pop into the the chatters list on the right?
Boy, it's going hot and heavy, too, it looks like.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes it gets kind of hard to catch some of the questions that are going through in the room, but this one was sent to me by Simon.
And I'm going to have to do this as a guest host for Angela. Boy, that's going to be hard. I'm going to really have to do my homework.
Oh, well, I'll tell you what.
Read at the same time. You have a talent, Dee.
Oh, well, I do have help. My husband is an admin in the room, and he can point out questions for me. I can do that for you during when you're doing Angela's show.
Yeah. Good deal.
We've got about 4 minutes left. And I want to get this question in before we have to go. This is from Skymon, and his question is, what does Frank think of third-generation night vision and Ed Grimley's Skywatches?
Well, another good question. I was actually invited out a while back. In fact, I guess the offer still stands to go out and go out to Ed's place. He's not too far away from me. And I'm thoroughly impressed with what he has observed with the night vision. And I know another researcher who's a good friend of mine that because of Ed's work, and he did, in fact, go out to visit with Ed, and he saw some very interesting things that were just unexplainable. And, yeah, it just, it all, it's almost makes it mandatory for every UFO researcher to have that type of equipment in their inventory. I'm very, very impressed with Grimley's work, and there's been some others that have captured some interesting images with the third gen night vision. It's mind-boggling, quite frankly.
I've seen some of the video footage that he's done, and I have to admit, it's pretty amazing stuff.
Agreed.
Let's see, we've got a little less than 3 minutes. Is there anything on your mind that you would like to say to our listeners?
Well, I thoroughly enjoyed being here, that's for sure. It's been a lot of fun, and I'm a fan of your show, and as you have mentioned, you've had guests on that are regular writers for the UFO Chronicle, and great minds think alike, of course, in that regard.
Well, thank you.
I'm also looking forward to the guest hosting Angela's show. That's going to be fun. And we are, for the record, we are throwing our hat into the podcast sphere relatively shortly. We've been working on it for a while. So we're going to lend our voice and put it out there and see what we can do.
Cool.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. I think all of us, I oftentimes use Angela as an example, although she wasn't a direct witness, you know, she's been smitten by the UFO bug. And this happens when you absorb the reality of it. I often talk to people about skeptics, and quite frankly, I feel I'm a skeptic. And I was tasked a few years back to find a skeptic to speak at the Aztec symposium, and I found out that the best skeptics are, in fact, ufologists. I could not find an objective skeptic. I could only the folks that called themselves skeptics were in fact debunkers. And I did eventually find a fella in England who I had the greatest respect for, and he was very objective. He was on the other side of the table, but he made plausible arguments. He was open-minded, and he, in my view, fit the bill for the most part. But we just couldn't get his schedule to jive. And we couldn't bring him in. As for me, the work goes on. We're ever expanding the UFO Chronicles. In fact, we've been asking for any military personnel that have had experiences in the past or recently to chime in and share their experiences. We do, at the top of the site, you can click on a button up there that says share my UFO experience.
Your web address?
It's the UFOChronicles.com.
And unfortunately, on that note, we are out of time. It sure did. You know, this is a conversation that I'd love to carry on for another 2 hours, but unfortunately, there's another program coming up next.
I understand.
Thank you very much for joining us tonight. I enjoyed this, and my audience has really enjoyed it. As you can see on the screen, you can see how they're all saying great show and all.
I've been trying to figure out how to talk on here.
thank
you to everybody that's in the Pal Talk room. And Dee, it's the pleasure's been mine, really. I thoroughly enjoyed myself.
Oh, well, I did too. And I know everybody in the auditorium did, and my other listeners around. Unfortunately, we're all out of time. I want to thank everyone for tuning in tonight and everyone in the Pal Talk Auditorium. Great bunch of questions, gang. I appreciate it.
That's for sure.
Stay tuned for Voice of the People, hosted by November Hansen. Her guest tonight is Paul, I believe it's pronounced Rademacher?
That's close enough.
Please join us again next Saturday on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network for another episode of Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis. Until then, keep an eye to the sky. Good night, everyone.